So this talk is branded UWA. It's myself, a PhD student called Anne Manhees, Olivia Mateo, who is an expert on identifying all the algae we have collected, and Derek Hendrick. But I also want to mention that a lot of the data in this talk come from the broader Coral Reef Health Group, which the macroalgal package fits into. And in particular, some of the grazing data that I'm going to show at the end have been collected in collaboration with Ross Babcock and Matt van der Klift. So macroalgae are a very important component of coral reefs, especially as they provide habitat. Excuse me, my voice is a bit croaky today. They provide habitat and food for a range of important species. But as we all know, there are a number of factors that can sort of tip the balance between macroalgae and coral habitats. And as we saw in this previous presentation, we can get transitions from these coral-dominated states to macroalgal-dominated states. Some of the reasons for this could be overfishing, increasing nutrient inputs. Corals could be killed by disease or bleaching as temperatures increase. And also ocean acidification may be a future stress that can sort of tip this delicate balance. So this is kind of the background against which we want to look at the state of the macroalgal communities in the Pilbara region. So I'm going to show you three broad areas that we've looked at. We first wanted to just characterize the communities of macroalgae in the region. They've been very well described in terms of the taxonomic richness in the past, but we know very little of their abundance and how they've changed over time. Second, we looked at some environmental and biotic drivers and tried to explain the patterns in the macroalgal communities that we were seeing. And finally, we wanted to kind of delve a little bit into how grazing and growth are balanced in the region, and what this might mean for how the algae are developing over time. So just to show you a broad overview of where we've sampled, these are the same sites that were used for the coral reef health studies in the program. We sampled in November 2013 and May 2014, and you can see a number of sites broadly covering the region between Exmouth and Dampier in both seasons. And what these maps are showing are the numbers of species in the color scale. So these are some of the hotspots where we found over 50 species. And then the circle size relates to the biomass. And you can already kind of discern a bit weak, but there is a pattern of higher biomass in November compared to May. So we sampled a total of 75 sites. We, as in Lydian, identified overall about 180 species. And on average, the number of species per site were 18, but obviously this varied quite a lot between the different sites. The median biomass, you can see that both median and mean biomass were higher in November, and the maximum biomass was as high as 574 grams of dry weight per meter square. And to look a little bit closer at this data set, we split it into the sort of different taxonomic groups. We have the red algae, the green algae, and the brown algae, and the scales are similar. We have number of species in the color scale, and the size of the circles relate to the biomass. And one thing that is very apparent in the data set, which is kind of what we would expect, is that most of the species richness can be attributed to the red algae. So they're a very diverse group overall. Whereas if we look at the data set in terms of biomass, most of the biomass can be attributed to the brown algae. Seagrasses, which are shown here in blue, were found sort of patchily throughout the region, probably because we sampled habitats that are not necessarily seagrass habitats. And so for the rest of the analysis, I'm mostly going to talk about the macroalgae. But another thing I want you to observe is that aside from the possibility of there being a spatial pattern in the biomass, we don't necessarily see any very strong spatial trends pop out in the data set. So the next thing we wanted to do was to look at the data set that we had and try and model it against some environmental and biotic drivers that we also collected data for. So these data, some of the measurements were collected in situ in this study, and this was mainly by Mick Haywood and Russ Babcock and others, Damien as well, who did coral transects alongside our sample sites, or at the same sample sites. So we collected algae from small quadrats, 6 quadrats per site. Then we also have extracted satellite data, mostly relating to water clarity, some sea surface temperature data, and salinity data for the sites. Because we didn't have a complete data set for all sites, we had to drop some sites, so we ended up with about 50 sites for the subsequent analysis. So as you saw in the first talk by Roland, there are nice spatial gradients north to south, and also onshore, offshore, in a lot of these environmental variables. And this is also what we found for our data set, obviously. But when we look at the overall structure of the macroalgal community, it doesn't seem to cluster very well. And this is just showing one example of sort of the May samples versus the November samples. You can see a little bit of separation. But I've also obviously looked at this cross-shelf, different regions and so on, and no real patterns stand out. So instead, we used the PERMANOVA methods to look at the data and how it relates to all these different environmental variables. We tested the biomass and species richness of the full data set, so all of the algae together. And then we split the data into different taxonomic groups. So we looked at the reds separately, the greens, the browns, and then finally we looked at a few genera that were either very diverse or very abundant. And these two graphs show you the distal M's for the total data set. You can see that in both cases, this is biomass at the top and species richness at the bottom. Rugosity was the main explaining variable, explaining most of the variability in the data set. You can see that biomass tends to increase as rugosity increases, and then we see the same for species richness. So all of the other variables that follow in the list are plotted on the y-axis, and you can see that sea surface temperature, diffuse attenuation, and hard coral cover pop up as important for both species richness and biomass, and here the uniformity of the sediment also plays a role. In general, with these types of models, we were able to explain between 50 and 80% of the variability in the macrophyte data set, and this is in terms of the biomass or the species richness. Interestingly, all of the models included sea surface temperature, and I think this is a really interesting finding, because of course we know that we've had these heat waves and this large variability in the region, in granular variability, and that's going to be key to how the algae are going to react and interact with the corals in the future. Two of the other key factors that came out as an overall in the models were rugosity, which generally had a positive effect on the algae, and hard coral cover, which was negatively correlated to both biomass and species richness. We thought herbivore abundance would be important, but it actually explained very little of the variability and was only included in a few of the models that we tested. And this graph shows you a summary of all of the distal M's for the macroalgal community structure. So here in each model, we've looked at the community in terms of both the biomass of each species. So if we look at the percent of variability explained, you can see that these models tend to have a lower percentage explained overall. But the general trend that we're seeing is that hard coral plays an important role in most of these models. Rugosity, again, is important, and sea surface temperature comes out as a very important variable. Here we also find that sea surface salinity is important, and for some of the models that where we tested the brown algae, sediment properties emerged as important variables. So there's a lot of, I have a lot of data and a lot of different model results. I'm just showing you a few key things, and I think the key message is the hard coral, sea surface temperature, and rugosity were the most important. So finally, we've tried to look a little bit more at the processes that regulate the macroalgal communities, and we wanted to see if we could say anything about the balance between grazing and growth. And what I'm going to show you is just data from a couple of pilot studies that we've done in the last year or so. The first one, which has been largely done by my PhD student Dan Van Hees, looked at growth and consumption in the Dampier archipelago. So there were two studies done, one in October and one in April, just gone. We looked at just one species, an abundant sargassum species. Actually, they looked at three species, but one, I'm going to show you data for just one of them. We compared inshore and offshore sites because we knew that they would differ in some of the environmental variables. We have had some wave gauges and temperature gauges out. So we compared inshore and offshore locations, and there were significant differences in wave height and temperature, but they were very similar in terms of the depth and light. So this is the species that was present at most of the sites, sargassum oligosystem. And what I'm showing you here is the fall sampling and the spring sampling, and we have inshore versus offshore. So these box plots, if we first look at the consumption, which is measured as grams per day, we can see that it's generally quite consistent between inshore and offshore and the season, except that offshore in the fall, there was a very large amount of biomass lost from these samples. And this kind of ties in with the net growth, which obviously takes into account both growth and consumption. So we find that the corresponding measurement of growth in the fall was very low, whereas the inshore of the same year, there was a slight positive net growth, and the same was found in the spring. And unfortunately, we couldn't find enough plant material to measure growth inshore in the spring. So we've done similar measurements in Ningaloo. We've measured growth and consumption at Bundigi and Mandu, and also have one site at Osprey. And this were done in October 2015 and April 2016. And here we've had a few more methodological issues that we're trying to come to grips with. One thing was that we have, to measure the consumption, we have controls that are supposed to really not lose very much biomass, lose or gain very much biomass. But we found that in this case, some of these controls lost a significant amount of biomass or gained quite a large amount. So we have a few doubts about the methods used. And it's possible that some of the loss that we're measuring here is actually due to erosion, so just the plant was ripped off by current or waves. But just to show you what the data do look like, and to highlight again another problem that we've come across, in the fall, we were not able to measure net growth because there was not enough plant material. You tagged the plants in situ, and the plant material that was there was not enough to get measurements from the two sites that we were interested in. They did measure growth in the spring, but these measurements are three different species, so it's very difficult to interpret and compare these two sites. And then here on the right we have consumption for sargassum oligosystem, for Bundigi, Mandu, and Osprey. We do have measurements for both fall and spring, but as I said, we're a little bit worried about the methods maybe not properly taking into account loss from erosion as well as grazing. So to summarize, the macrophyte communities in the Pilbara, as we already knew, have a high level of diversity. There's a lot of spatial heterogeneity and complexity. We did find a little bit of a seasonal pattern, but there's very little spatial structure in terms of the communities. The distal-line models showed us that rugosity, hard cover, and sea surface temperature, and also salinity, were the main drivers of the community composition, as well as the biomass and diversity. At Dampier, we managed to measure both growth and consumption of sargassum over the system, and we did see some temporal and spatial patterns, but at Ningaloo, the results are much more difficult to interpret, so we have to be a little bit cautious and see what we can do with the data there. Thank you.
I don't know much about macroalgae in that area, but do they undergo senescence?
Yes.
And between November and May, and if they do, how do you separate out that confounding factor driving the model showing that SST was a main driver of changing biomass for particular sargassum species? Did you look at that?
So I'm not sure if I understand the question correctly, but in the SST measurements, we had one that was just the average SST, and then we had the SST at the time of sampling, which actually is very closely correlated to the season or the month of sampling. So we did a draft loss plot and eliminated month as a variable. So that will separate the sites in terms of their seasonality, yes. But yes, of course, this...
Because they undergo senescence and are dying anyway.
Yeah.
So your biomass will be reduced naturally, so
yeah.
SST will also reduce,
then. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's why you see a seasonal pattern. It's almost strange that we don't see a stronger seasonal pattern. We would expect the biomass to be more distinct between November and April. So you're correct. But one of the limitations of this, obviously, as you point out, is that it is really a snapshot. We've tried to pick 2 months where we thought we would catch two distinct periods in terms of the growing patterns of the algae, but still, we don't know what happens the rest of the year necessarily at these particular sites.